This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
From Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, Case 38, a buffalo passes through a window, the main case. Wu Tzu Fayan said, to give an example, it's like a buffalo passing through a window. Its head, horns, and four legs have all passed through. Why is it that its tail cannot? Wu Men's Commentary. If you can penetrate to the point of this koan, open your Dharma eye to it and give a turning word, you'll then be able to repay the four obligations above and help the three existences below. If you still cannot do so, work with this tale single-heartedly until you can really grasp it as your own. A poem. If it passes through, it falls into a ditch. If it turns back, it's destroyed. This tiny tale, how extremely marvelous. So this is our New Year's session, first session of this year. And so even though we're just really days into the new year, and so to think of beginning again, the mind that is fresh and new, open, spacious, you know, the essence of any spiritual practice is returning to it over and over and over and over, day after day, week after week, year after year. And to do that, in order for it to be alive, the mind has to be fresh. And so one aspect of Seishin is really mind training in how do you stay alive within your root practice, moment after moment, period after period, day after day. It's not a small thing. It's available to everybody. That's our natural mind is always fresh and clear, but we start to create things and go to sleep a little and then go to sleep a lot. This path, Buddha nature, Prajnaparamita, absolute reality, does not take a stand in anything. Does not dwell or make its home in anything. And so we move beyond, free ourselves of sights and sounds, names, ideas in the mind, so that we can be fresh and new within our world of sights and sounds and ideas and names. We use what we call Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, what we call liturgy, what we call Zazen and Kinnin, Oryoki, Teisho, prostrations, in order to be fresh and clean of any idea of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, prostrations, and Zazen. Really, ultimately, we have to have the faith that by letting go of everything that matters most in your world, in your life, you can discover the source of everything that matters. And that's not so easy to do. To truly let go in your mind of everything that to you matters the most. This is a koan that Master Hakuin, when he revived the koan system in Japan and put different koans into kind of different categories of what they were addressing. So Dharmakaya koans and koans that address the differentiation, koans that deal with the merging of relative and absolute, koans that deal with the precepts, and the five ranks, and so on. And then there was a group of koans he called Nanto koans, which are, he said, are difficult to pass through. This is one of them. So Master Wutsu Fayan said, to give an example, it's like a buffalo passing through a window. It's massive head, horns, huge body, legs, have all passed through. Why is it that its tail cannot? When we enter the way, we have to begin at the beginning. Where else would you begin a journey? So the Buddha said the beginning is life is dukkha. To be willing to acknowledge and turn towards this basic reality, spoken from the ground of reality. And this is not a statement of judgment or of opinion or criticism or defeat. It's just the essential first step. Life is dukkha. To stop and see in every moment how the self projects into things, to accumulate, to become, to acquire, to be affirmed. And it appropriates, takes things on. This is mine, this is mine, this is mine. This is me, this is me. And rejects a different kind of identification, what I'm not. This is not me. And of course, we have others' selves projected onto us. It's like a big mixer party. The middle way is not a sight or a sound. It's not an idea. It's not a thing. You can't touch it. You can't hold it. You can't bring it with you. You can't be without it. How do we practice it? How do we practice fundamental reality in which you cannot stand, in which you cannot hold? How do you turn towards what is not a single thing and study without touching, without holding? The Buddha said, avoid all extremes. Simple advice. Avoid every extreme. Another way of saying that is just in every thought and every word and action, just practice the path of non-binding, non-attachment, which is to neither hold nor reject. It's really simple. And then, with our minds tuned to that, we begin to see our frequent, seemingly incessant grasping at desired states, to feel something, to feel a certain way, to experience something, to have the world be a certain way, to achieve some state in which we hope to find something. And usually find a little bit, a little shred, a little trace of that something which keeps us going. Life is dukkha. Because the Buddha said this is a sure path to disappointment. And soon. You don't have to wait long. satisfaction, sense of being betrayed, defeated. And so all forms of practice, everything we do, is this path of non-grasping. And so passing through the window is crossing over to the other shore. It's the practice of the paramitas, from samsara to enlightenment, from the profane to the sacred, from suffering to peace and joy. Why won't this tail pass through? What is passing through? What is this tail? I was listening again to an interview recently with a poet named Christian Wiman, who grew up in Texas, grew up hard, violence, and a very intense and kind of cloistered, strict Christian upbringing. Then he left it all and tumbled into all kinds of mischief, and eventually found his way back into Christianity. And is a, I think, a deep thinker and poet. And he said, we tend to think of love, and I'm going to include hatred here, as closing out the world, and we can only see the face of our beloved or of the one we hate, and that everything else goes quiet or goes numb. But actually, what I've experienced is that love or hatred demands to be something else. That is, if we're on a true path, it demands to be something else. It demands to be expressed beyond the expression of the participant. It needs to be expressed beyond just the person who is loving or hating. It keeps demanding more, he says. And that excess energy, I think, is God, or the absolute nature. And I think it's God in us trying to return to its source. I don't know how else to understand it. I think we have these experiences, and they're spiritual experiences. And then religion comes after that. Religion is everything that we do with those moments of intense spirituality in our lives. He says, being religious or taking on some sort of religious elements in your life doesn't mean you're necessarily saying, I agree with everything this religion says. What we're saying is that I've had these incredible experiences in my life of suffering, joy, both, and they have demanded some action of me and demanded some continuity of me. And the only way that I know to do this is to try and find some way, some form in it, and to try and share it with other people. I thought that was a very nice way of, from a different path, speaking of bodhicitta, of having intense experiences in life. It could be very high, they could be very low. And because there is already some light, some questioning, some desire to actually live, those experiences demand more. I like that. They don't leave us alone. They haunt us. They inspire us. They provoke us. Sometimes they take us all the way down the rabbit hole. Sometimes they take us all the way up, and then that all dissolves. But all the while, they're demanding something of me, some action, some continuity. You know, it was demanding something, not just in a moment, in an instant, or today, but something ongoing. And I have to find some way to respond to that. And that's what we call this. And so here we are, practicing Sesshin, sitting, facing the wall, facing the mind. The whole of the life, one's life, your life, comes up moment after moment. In small moments, inane, trivial, superficial moments, petty moments, and deep moments, big moments. Some lull you to sleep, some shake you to your roots. And they're all demanding something of us. Maybe that's the greatest regret of all, is when we have encountered things in our life and been demanded of and have not responded. Studying the self of love and hate to go beyond love and hate, because if we want to understand the root of all that is good and all that is not good, of that which matters most, we have to let go. We have to put it down and understand that in that, that is not disregard or ignoring, because that's one extreme. We are not to do that. So how do you put something down without disregarding it? How do you let go of what matters most, truly, completely, in your mind, so that you can live what matters most? To return to the source, to pass through the window, to cross over to the other shore, to reach the mountain peak, all of these images that are used, not just in Buddhism, but in other traditions. Right? Speaking of a journey, a path, moving from somewhere to somewhere. Responding to that, being demanded of. Master Fayan was once asked by a student, what is the one drop of Bayun? Bayun was his teacher. What is one drop of Bayun? And Fayan said, pounding, grinding. And the student says, how is it for those who drink this one drop? Fayan said, I teach of a place where no face appears. What is one drop of Bayun? What is one drop of Buddha? Pounding, grinding. It can seem like that. In Zen tradition, we speak of mutual polishing. That's what this is. Mutual polishing. There's enough distance between us that you can have your own seat, sit in your own solitude, but not so much distance that you don't rub up against. I polish you, you polish me. To bring out the shine, the luster. But how is it before having drunk this one drop? So Japanese master Musō Saseki, who lived in the 13th, 14th century, and he spoke of, in one of his teachings, about three kinds of compassion. And what I want to do over the next couple of talks during the week is I want to come back to this koan, work with this koan. You know, in the koan tradition, there's a what you might call a transmission of the koan, understanding of the koan that is understood, is to be understood by each student as it was understood by that student's teacher, and by that student's teacher. And also recognizing that each koan is like a jewel, like a diamond, and so you can look at it from different facets. And some of those facets might be true, some of them will be false, but so what I wanted to do is look at different elements that are within this koan, right? Which is really just another way of saying different elements that are within our practice. Saseki speaks of it in terms of compassion. And so he says there are three types of compassion. The first is compassion directed towards sentient beings. The second is based on Dharma. And the third is compassion without any object. And so what is compassion that is directed towards sentient beings? He says, this is the type of compassion that regards sentient beings suffering in the cycle of birth and death as actually existing, and that strives to liberate these beings from this world of delusion. This is the compassion of an earlier stage bodhisattva, although it is superior to the aspiration of a practitioner who has no aspiration to alleviate the suffering of beings, who is only practicing for themselves. It is nevertheless a substantialist view because it adheres to the concept of benefit, reward, gaining merit, creating good karma. And thus it is not true compassion. It's like in the Vimalakirti Sutra, when Vimalakirti criticizes this form of compassion, sentimental compassion, compassion marked by affection and false views. And so in the beginning, we enter into practice within the teaching that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness is exactly form. All dharmas are forms of emptiness. Nothing is ever born or destroyed. Nothing ages and dies. And so we may believe that, we may want to believe that, we may have faith in it or want to have faith in it, but we don't know this to be true. We take it on some measure of faith that this is true, but we don't know yet. And so how do we practice that Dharma? Not only when we don't know yet that it's true, but we have probably just a little bit of faith in it, a little bit of willingness. And so when we engage in training, we begin to encounter simple moments that are both conveying this and that are also bringing us into that reality, that whole reality. In other words, the reality that he's speaking of here, that the suffering of sentient beings and me actually exists in its own right, has its own being, its own independent life. It's happening to me. And that all of that is empty. And so when you come into to the Zendo and bow to your seat, it's your responsibility. No one else. And then you turn and you bow to the Sangha. You can't do it alone. It needs to be for self and other. Mutually suffering, mutually liberated. Thus we eat this food with everyone. We eat with everyone to stop all evil, to practice good, to save all sentient beings and accomplish the way. This moment of taking this bite, swallowing this food, being nourished, is with everyone. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing here and now. My nature, your nature. And here I stand, opposite you. I hear my voice, I hear your voice. Practice is continuously bringing our attention to the study of the self, this moment, this mind. And also to the effect of that on you, on each other. To It's alignment with the Dharma. It's conflict with the Dharma. And so experiencing in my mind, in my body, in my emotions, in exchange of words with others, in my work, all the many forms of suffering, and believing that they have their own existence, I practice compassion. And compassion, it can't be practiced but for wisdom. And so as with so many things in Dharma practice, we speak of one thing, but we have to understand that we're speaking of all things. We have a responsibility to ourselves for this life. We have a responsibility to others. Believing, experiencing things as having their own reality. But entering into the teaching that all things exist as one essence. All things have one nature. And that one nature appears clothed, draped, enlivened by its characteristics. And so within that some degree of faith and the very present reality of what I experience and the sense of actuality of that, it is. Within all of that, sit awake. Sit at ease. Focus your mind here. And know that that mind, this awareness, this moment is vast and boundless. See things just as they are, free of names, free of opinions. Trust your mind's ability to be free of thought. Become disenchanted. Become disenchanted with your mind. I remember one person many, many years ago who in guarding council asking to enter into formal training when asked about the challenges that she expected to encounter, she said, with relish, I love my thoughts. That was one honest answer. Because it is that things do appear to have their own reality. We recognize them one from another. We experience their weight, their drag, their lightness, their fluidity, their qualities. And so how to experience that honestly, directly, and stay true to the path of not clinging. And the greater the weight, the more the drag, the more delightful the lightness, the easier the flow of the fluidity, the more clinging there will be. And so to practice not clinging, to let it go. And if you can't let it go, to let it stay within non-clinging as your practice of not clinging. And if it you let it stay, and it stays and stays and stays, then there are other practices All that we do, whether it's liturgy, body practice, art practice, all that we do is this path of non-attachment. So in one sense, all that we do has an actual consequence, right? At the end of the meal crew, the kitchen is clean. At the end of work practice, tasks have been accomplished. And those are true in their own right. And the reason we do them here is because they're a vehicle. They provide us with a way, a moment, a particular opportunity to live this life of non-attachment. When we get hung up in stuff during session, as a resident, at home, wherever we might be, and that's what matters most, is the cause of our getting hung up, then in some way we have lost our way on that path of non-attachment. But practicing that path has to be honest and true. Otherwise, it won't bring us liberation. And so the Buddha said, just avoid the extremes, which are basically all the ways of not practicing, not clinging. There is something there. What is it? Things do appear to be real. We see them. We feel them. We hear them. Never deny that. Don't add to it. We practice it as it appears, but with the faith that there is a reality, not a deeper reality, not an underlying reality. This reality that is difficult to see, that you cannot see with your senses. All that we can see with our senses is that which has texture and quality and characteristic. When that's all that we see, that's all there is. And that's why we practice, because we have to experience that true nature. And so to practice being at ease within your body, within the sensations, within your sleepiness, within your pain. To be at ease means to be alive, bright, and relaxed. I think we all come into practice numb. I do. I think everybody comes into practice numb, to some degree. Numb to our body, numb to our feelings, to sensations, to other people, to the impact of our thoughts, our desires. Because we've all come in through life, in life, having experienced things that were difficult. And our brain is in charge of ordering our world and creating some sense of safety. This is a world you can live in. And this is a world you can live in. But with really strong experiences of pain and suffering, sometimes the way that that's been calibrated is the world is not a safe place to live. This body is not a safe place to live in. And so this slow process of reclaiming, re-inhabiting this world of body and mind, of heart, of thoughts and emotions, but really inhabiting them. Being lost in thought is not yet inhabiting thought. Being lost or entangled in emotion is not yet having reclaimed emotion. And so we practice having faith in that which we do not yet know, and then we verify it on the path of non-attachment. I was listening to an interview with a therapist, a psychiatrist, who's done a lot of sort of foundational work in trauma. And he was talking about, the interview asked him how he started, and he said he used to work for the veterans, VA, because it was a way for him to basically get his career going. And the first person he met with was a Vietnam veteran who was having really terrible nightmares about, you know, having been at war and lost, having lost so many of his friends. And this therapist had done a lot of research in nightmares, so he was like, oh, I can help you with this. So he prescribed him some medication. And when the guy comes back for this next appointment, the psychiatrist says, how is that working? Is the medication helping you? He goes, I didn't take any of it. And he goes, why? And he says, because those nightmares are my memorial to all of my buddies who didn't come home. And he said that so many of these memories and these bodily held sensations, some actively, some just deeply without thought or decision, he said, are testimonials to that which no longer exists. I thought that was a nice way of putting it, testimonials to something that happened and something that is happening right now, but the testimonial is to something that no longer exists. And so how do we practice the reality, the experienced reality that we encounter so vividly in practice, within the faith that that reality itself is described in Buddhism as illusory? And that's tricky to call it that, because it makes it sound like it's not happening. But that's not what that means, right? And so that's why the examples that are often used are of a sleight of hand or a magician's trick. There is something that's happening. You're watching it. But there's something else going on that we can't see. And what magicians say is that what makes a magic trick work is that the magician gets you to look at what they want you to look at. And they get you to not look at what they don't want you to look at. That's pretty cool. It's pretty deluded. And so evidently with skill, some skill, magicians can get us, can basically manipulate us to not see what is happening right in front of us. And so how much more difficult to see what is happening right in front of us but can't be seen? Not with these eyes. We have to see in a different way. We have to let go of seeing and hearing and feeling and thinking. But the only way to do that is by being so awake and so at ease within your senses that they rest. When there's that much trust. And that's, I think, why it's a long path. Because you can't force that. You can't make that happen. It's not a matter of will. This buffalo passes through the window, letting go of all clinging to head, horns, body, legs. When you let go in that moment, having passed through, you carry nothing with you and you leave nothing behind. And that's why faith is important. And faith in Dharma And Buddha Dharma means faith in that which we cannot see, but can realize. The nature, and Christian Wiman says this about faith. Of course, he's speaking from a Christian perspective, but he says faith is, to him, he says, is not a state of mind, but an action in the world, a movement towards the world. He says, the way I've defined it to myself is, I think of belief as having objects. Faith doesn't have objects. Faith is an orientation of your life, or it's an energy of your life, or however you want to define it. But I think it's objectless. That the nature of it is to have no object. It's like the difference between expectation and aspiration. Expectation, we have a clear sense of what's going to happen. Aspiration does not have that. And to many people, that just seems kind of crazy, right? How can you have a great aspiration, and when they ask you, and if you answer truthfully, what is that? And you say, I don't know. They'll think you're in trouble, right? And that's the leap, right? We even talk about it that way. It's a leap of faith. A leap from that which we know, from that which we expect. And yet within aspiration, it's not ambiguous, it's not ambivalent. Not knowing is not confusion. Confusion is packed with knowing. There's a clear path, there's a strong commitment to the objectless. And so practice from the very beginning, before we know it, before we can recognize it, is practicing that while we stand on the very ground where we're still convinced everything is an object. Everything is just what it appears to be. You know, there's that parable in the Lotus Sutra where a bunch of people are going on a trip up through very difficult terrain to a place with many treasures, and they have a guide. And so they set off and they're full of excitement and confidence, but it's long and it's difficult. Right? It starts to get real. It's like before they left, they thought, sure, I'm up for this. I'm ready to do this. I know it's going to be difficult. But they don't know that yet. Right? That's the idea. And so the difficult that is framed in the mind is not difficult, actually. But when they encounter it, it's difficult. And so they start to get tired and lacking in confidence. They start to feel defeated. They say, we can't do this. Let's go back. We have to go back. And so the guy thinks, oh, what a shame. They're on this path. What they seek, they will find. But they must keep going. And so he conjures up a magical city. And he says, listen, look. Don't worry, everything's fine. Let's go into this place because it's amazing and anything you want is there. So just kick back and relax, right? Forget about the journey for a while. And they do that. They kick back, they relax, they eat, they refresh themselves. And then that difficulty suddenly, it's not so bad, right? Because they've been refreshed, restored. And in the moment when the guide realizes that that's happened, it all disappears. He says, okay, let's go. You can't stay here. Right? This is no place to stay. We have to keep going. And they say, okay, we can do that. Right? Because they've been refreshed. And training is very much like that. Right? That there we have to move forward and be effortful. And move through, into and through those difficulties, those steep inclines, those places that are dark and experience being disheartened, being filled with doubt, losing faith. It's not a question of if. It's going to happen. It's happening. That's how you find your way. That's how you find the path. That's how you find this Dharma. And so we'll keep looking at this in the next couple of days. So let's just really use this time. Practice what is before you. Use, you know, the very important part of Sesshin is that the whole day is one period of zazen, one period of meditation. If you think of it that way, during which just things happen, bells ring, feet take steps, food is chewed, talks are heard, dishes are washed, beds are laid down in, but it's all one meditation. And with a poem. The great way is vast and contains the multitude. Today, it's difficult and steep and dark. And so I walk slowly, weighed down by the ancient cries. If I set you down along the way, know that this is my birthright. As ordained by you, and know that it is not of my own doing. Setting down your ancient cries is your birthright. As ordained by you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.